This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
I'm Jerry Willis.
I'm Steve Ducey.
I'm Shannon Bream, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Monday, November 14th, 2022, I'm Mike Emanuel. The expected red wave in this year's midterm elections did not pan out. But in Long Island, where Republicans are quite outnumbered by Democrats, the GOP was able to pull off quite the victory. A former NYPD detective made the case for change.
You don't win elections in Nassau County only based on conservatives and Republicans voting for you. You win those elections based on people from different parties crossing that line.
I'm Chris Foster. Muppets in Moscow, the story of bringing Sesame Street to Russia.
There was a battle at the time for control of the TV station. As we see now, you know, under Putin, the power of television is enormous, especially when it goes across 11 time zones, which it did in the 1990s. So people were battling to control that and to control public opinion and power.
And I'm James Carafano, and I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
The anticipated red wave in the 2022 midterms never materialized. Republican Study Committee Chairman Jim Banks vented his frustration with Republicans coming up short.
This was a very disappointing outcome on election night, not the one that we expected. And there will be a lot of unpacking of the outcome for weeks to come. Did we have the wrong strategy? Why did our message not break through?
With inflation and concerns of a recession, the crime crisis in many cities, and an out-of-control situation at our southern border, Republicans were convinced the issues favored the GOP. New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu says Republicans underperformed.
I didn't predict the results. I thought we were going to have a pretty good red wave. So more like a red ripple, but it should have been a lot stronger than it was.
In True Blue New York, Republican nominee for governor Lee Zeldin came up short against Democrat Kathy Hochul. But Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton says Zeldin's great work paid off in other races.
Lee Zeldin in New York, for instance, he ran a great campaign. He helped four different congressional candidates get across the finish line, which may be the difference in the House of Representatives.
Among the Republican winners in New York, Congressman-elect Mike Lawler, who defeated the Democrats' campaign committee chairman, Sean Patrick Maloney.
And we got a fair set of maps, which is why New York Republicans flipped four seats, and we're going to have a total of 11 members going down to Washington.
Also joining him in the next freshman class, a former NYPD officer and former firefighter.
I think the key to victory in Nassau County and across Long Island was the fact that we really stuck to the issues that mattered most to the people on Long Island and specifically in my district.
Congressman-elect Anthony D'Esposito will represent New York's 4th congressional district.
And those issues were the ones that were talked about most, and it was crime, it was cost of living, it was inflation, it was concerns about the border. You know, it was the issues that affected people's pockets. And as the Democrats tried to veer the campaign off in other directions, not saying that those issues were not important. You know, we remained clearly on point, clearly on message, and I think that's really what put us over the edge. And then, you know, you can't put aside the fact that Lee Zeldin ran a tremendous race. I mean, he ran one of the best gubernatorial elections we've seen in a long, long time. Getting 48% of the vote in a place like New York State is unheard of. So without a doubt, Lee Zeldin helped individuals up and down the ballot across New York State.
You guys are coming to town for freshman orientation. I'm sure you've got a lot of questions you want to ask. And as you come here, what are you looking forward to doing? And do you come here with the mentality of what got you elected and staying focused on those core principles going forward?
Yeah, I'm focused on what matters most to the people of this district. And, you know, this obviously, as everyone knows, Nassau County is a county that Democrats outnumber Republicans by a substantial amount. So the only way to govern is by reaching across the aisle and delivering for Long Island. And that's exactly what I intend to do. I did it as a town Hempstead council member, working in a bipartisan fashion to deliver tax cut budgets and improve our rating on Wall Street, and I plan on doing the exact same thing in Washington. That's the only way to govern, and it's the only way to appeal to the voters in this district.
As someone who's never been a congressman before, do you have a lot of questions for the boot camp you're about to go through?
Yeah, listen, I think anytime you come into a situation that you're not familiar with, there's a lot of questions. But, you know, I was a proud member of the New York City Police Department, where I was a decorated detective. I worked in some of the most violent precincts in New York City. If I can handle that, I think I'm ready for the halls of Capitol Hill.
Talk a little bit about your background for people around the country who may not be familiar with you. You touched on your police experience. What about the fire department? And how do those skills train you for where you are today?
Yeah, so born and raised on the South Shore of Long Island in Island Park, went to Chaminade High School and Hofstra University, joined the New York City Police Department, where I retired with over 600 arrests as a decorated detective. I'm also a former chief of the Island Park Fire Department here on Long Island. Our entire fire service is based on in a volunteer basis. So the volunteer fire service is definitely a big family here on Long Island, which without a doubt was a help in winning this election. But, you know, the experience that I've had in being a first responder in the public safety world, being a chief of a volunteer fire department, being a detective in the New York City Police Department, it gives you the ability. I always talk about the police department specifically. You know, I sat in the car with people who were from different economic backgrounds, different color skin, different religions, certainly different political ideologies. My life depended on them. Their life depended on me. And we got the job done. And that's exactly the way I, you know, bring myself to government. I'm willing to work with anyone as long as it delivers for the people that put their trust in me to represent them.
Among the discussions that you guys will have when you're in town is about the future leadership of the Republican-led House. Obviously, Kevin McCarthy has been in the kind of the driver's seat, thought of as a potential next Republican speaker. Some other folks are talking about potentially somebody else. Have you given a lot of thought to the leadership of your party as you come here to Congress?
When it comes to Leader McCarthy, he was someone who, from the beginning of this race, when many people said that it was an impossible feat and we would never win, you know, he was there, he gave support. And I told him recently that, you know, I would support him for Speaker of the House.
Is it frustrating for somebody who's been on the ballot that the process in terms of counting votes in some of these districts is taking so long? I mean, it's the year 2022. Before you know it, we'll be in the 2024 cycle. Wouldn't voting be a faster process in the United States of America at this point?
You would sure hope so. And it seems like it's always the same certain parts of this country that fall into this situation where we're waiting and waiting and waiting. You know, I think we need to definitely focus on the problems that we have and work in a bipartisan fashion to find some results.
So in terms of delivering for your constituents, obviously there are crime concerns in New York City. There are also inflation concerns, which is really biting everybody these days. Are those the kind of central issues that you're coming here thinking like, okay, we have to deliver for my constituents. We got to get some things done to make their lives better.
Absolutely. I mean, the crime issue, I think, is sort of something that we can talk about and deliver real resources, the same federal resources that I utilized when I was a New York City detective. When it comes to, you know, inflation and the cost of living, obviously, we need to focus on our party's commitment to America and becoming energy independent. But we also need to work here on Long Island. I think we need to focus on infrastructure and transportation. You know, we have a lot of smart growth. We have a lot of developments. And even though it's smart and it's good for the communities, it raises issues that need to be addressed. And I think that we have a real opportunity, especially with four members of the Republican Party and what will be the majority. I think if we work together, we can deliver some great things for Long Island.
Those in your district have traditionally voted blue when it comes to presidential elections. Do you think that will be the case in 2024, or do you think Republicans have an opportunity to convince your constituents that one-party rule in New York hasn't worked?
So I think it's clear that one-party rule hasn't worked in New York, but you know, I think we're going to see. We're going to work as hard as we can to make sure that we deliver the promises that we made to voters. And I think what's also important to point out is in a district where Democrats outnumber Republicans, When I ran for my last reelection as a town board member in 2021, I won with 70% of the vote. This year, I was, you know, blessed to get 52% of the vote and win by just over 11,000 votes. You don't win elections in Nassau County only based on conservatives and Republicans voting for you. You win those elections based on people from different parties crossing that line because they support you, they trust you, and they know that you're going to go out there and do the right thing. So I think that is the focus. We need to make, you know, obviously the Republican Party and the conservatives, we need to make sure that we keep working hard and producing and believing in our values, but we also need to continue to appeal to those that are not members of the Republican Conservative Party, because the independents and the Democrats, especially the moderate Democrats that I've spoken to across Long Island in this district, there are many, many Democrats. I remember doing the train stations over the last couple months, people coming up the train escalator and saying, I'm a lifelong Democrat. I will never vote Democrat again because I feel like I've lost my party because they've gone too far to the left. And those are the people that we need to appeal to. And I've spoken to people over the last week who have said, listen, I'm a Democrat and I voted for you. Please give me a reason to vote for you again in 2024. And my goal is to work as hard as I possibly can, deliver for Long Island, and not only have the vote of those Democrats who put their trust in me this time, but more Democrats who will believe in the work that we do for the future.
Was it encouraging for you how aggressively Republicans competed in a lot of these New York districts? Obviously, it's traditionally a very blue state. But I know from talking with Elise Stefanik, the House Republican Conference Chair, that she really thought that Republicans could win a whole lot of districts in New York. And so what did that mean to you that there was such an aggressive push to try to turn some of these traditional blue districts red?
Well, I think at first it was great to have the support of Elise and the NRCC and Chairman Emmer, because, you know, like I said in the beginning of the interview, you know, many people wrote, especially in my district, off. You know, it was a seat that's been held in Democratic hands for 25 years. And even my staunch supporters said, you know, Anthony, you have a great seat in the town of Hempstead. You won with great numbers. You know, why would you get involved and go into something where we don't think that we can win? And there was just a feeling there. You know, there was a feeling in the streets. There was a feeling from residents. And I felt good. I felt confident the whole time. And the fact that so many looked at New York and thought we could pick up seats. I mean, obviously, we thought there was going to be other seats picked up throughout the nation. And I think it's great to be a part of history that, you know, New York and these four seats on Long Island are the ones that could actually deliver the majority to the Republicans.
That's a great point. Okay, so here you're coming for boot camp in Washington. What are you looking forward to learning, or who are you looking forward to meeting while you're down here?
I'm looking forward to getting there this evening, you know, meeting with the members of the New York delegation. We're having a meeting for dinner tonight, so get to know one another. And tomorrow I'm looking forward to get to know everybody, you know, whether it's incoming Republicans and Democrats. We're going to have to all work together to, you know, understand the needs of the communities throughout the country that they represent. Getting to meet new people, getting to understand how things work on the Hill. And listen, being humble, keeping my eyes and ears open, rolling up my sleeves and getting to work.
Anthony D'Esposito, Republican Congressman-elect representing New York's 4th Congressional District. Congratulations. And we look forward to seeing you down here in Washington.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
This is James Carafano with your Fox News commentary. Coming up.
Sesame Street's been on TV since 1969. The goal, then and now, has been to teach preschoolers not just about ABCs and 1-2-3s, but how to get along. There are versions produced in other languages and countries around the world. And 30 years ago, after the fall of the Soviet Union, then-Senator Joe Biden called a hearing about sending Sesame Street to Russia as part of an aid package to help with education reform and to win over young hearts and minds. Ulita Sazam went on the air October 22nd, 1996. Getting it on the air wasn't easy.
the impetus for the show. I mean, basically at that time is, you know, everybody was kind of evangelical about capitalism at the time.
Natasha Lance Rogoff, a filmmaker and journalist who lived and worked in the Soviet Union, was hired as the show's executive producer. Her book about the experience is called Muppets in Moscow, The Unexpected Crazy True Story of Making Sesame Street in Russia.
You know, the prospect of Russia joining the free world, the open countries that are open. And yeah, there was an emphasis to try to provide a program for young children that would model idealistic values.
So
essentially tolerance, that sort of thing. Yeah, and so, yes, the government provided the support initially, but they insisted on the funding being matched by the Russian government or through investment in Russia. They didn't want to pay for it themselves entirely because they wanted the Russians also to have skin in the game.
Now, well, how do you go about putting the production together? You've got to find somebody to put it on TV. You've got to find somebody to pay for it. You've got to find, I assume, puppeteers. I assume, you know, writers, costumers, casting. How does all that happen?
It's very much like a tripod. I mean, the first step is to work with the government and the TV industry. And most countries have state-owned television. So usually you negotiate with that entity. But in this case, the state had just collapsed, essentially a year before. So the prospect of negotiating with what was now the new television station was really fuzzy. You know, who was in control there? And it really didn't work out very easily as far as trying to figure out who we could do a deal with. So we started talking to different people who had financing and access to the TV station, including some oligarchs. And that's how we started. So it's sort of like a tripod. First, you have to get a buy-in from the country where you're working. Then you work with researchers and educators to figure out what the country needs in terms of values and skills so that the content can be developed. Then you create a team. And in the case of Russia, when I was hired, I had insisted on working with independents as a way of developing infrastructure for independent media, because so many people who worked in the arts had really been persecuted under communism. So the idea was that we could bring in a lot of people, including musicians whose, you know, they had been banned under communism. They couldn't record their music. They couldn't sell their music. So when I was asked to do it, I said this, you know, I saw it as this incredible opportunity to give jobs and opportunity to a lot of the people, the artists that were marginalized under communism. And that's exactly what we did. What I did not expect to do that happened is that we ended up working also with the state television employees. And in the book, I talk about how that happened. So our team was a combination of the old guard and the new guard.
So you have these artists and these other people you're working with who are looking forward than other people who are maybe not so happy with how things are going in Russia.
I would say, you know, aside from dealing with a great deal of violence during the process of making this show with our broadcast partners getting assassinated, the office getting taken over by soldiers with AK-47s, and our first sponsor's car getting blown up.
Yeah, was that just people jockeying for position? Was that power jockeying? Was it censorship attempts? What was the violence about?
So most of these cases have never been solved. You know, they are still on the books in the Russian judicial system as unsolved. But there were a number of rumors, and there are some more obvious reasons why some of these people were assassinated. In the case of Vlad Listyev, who was a great man who was trying to bring press freedom to Russia in the mid 1990s until he was killed. And he also was not afraid to challenge the old guard in terms of their corruption. So he was trying to challenge the corruption inside the TV station. And he was killed, you know, shortly after his announcement that he was going to disrupt how advertising was done at the TV station. So pretty much a lot of people think that his death was related to that. And there was a battle at the time for control of the TV station, as we see now, you know, under Putin. The power of television is enormous, especially when it goes across 11 time zones, which it did in the 1990s. So people were battling to control that and to control public opinion and power.
I mean, look, right after the fall of the Soviet Union, we've alluded to this, a lot of Americans maybe thought, okay, they're just going to become another us, maybe with our help. But there was a lot of fear, people not knowing, well, how am I going to make a living? And then on the other hand, you had these sharks that were like, all right, this is my opportunity. I'm going to grab up everything I can.
This is a theme that, Putin has been drumming for years. And it is true that, you know, after the fall of the Soviet Union, it was an incredibly difficult period for many people, you know, extreme poverty. The ruble was devaluing by like 20% every month. There was lawlessness, corruption. And at the same time, you know, many companies from the West were flooding into Russia, seeing it as a new market, which it was. Big, huge market covering 1/7 the surface of the earth. And I remember at that time, I mean, I had been working in Russia already for so long, and I had gone to USAID and talked a lot. Also, you know, I made this film called Russia for Sale, The Rough Road to Capitalism. So I presented at the Senate, the US Senate, discussing about the process of reform in the former Soviet Union and how it was going to take a long time, and you had to change the consciousness of the society first before you just focused on building a market and, you know, using macroeconomic policies to stabilize the ruble. And it was very hard to get traction on that. Senator Carl Levin and Pamela Harriman, they were trying to help to discuss the sort of psychological process of shifting a society from a communist mentality to a more open mentality, how long that would take. So that was a very rough period for many people.
How long was the show on the air, and how many did you make? And then why did it get taken off?
In the Ulitsa Sezam season one, the show that I launched continued for 2 years, and it aired on Russia's largest television station. It was broadcast across the former Soviet Union to all the former republics that were now new independent countries like Ukraine, Armenia, Georgia. The show was, of course, in Russian, but at that point, most children were still being taught in Russian and, of course, were speaking Russian. So that is different now. But the show went on other seasons after that. I left the show after the first 2 years, and then Sesame Street continued it with the same team that we had assembled from 1995, 96, and it continued for the next 10 years, well into Putin's era, and became a huge hit and educated, you know, a generation of children. And many of them I meet all over the world when I ask them if they know the show Ulitsa Sezam, and they get very excited, just the same way Americans do here when we talk about Sesame Street and Elmo and Big Bird.
Did it peter out, or was it yanked when it finally ended?
It's very hard to find the exact answer to that. And over, you know, I was in Moscow in January of 2020. Interviewing my former colleagues, and everybody had a different answer. But the fact is, you know, at the end there, you know, Putin had already started leaning on independent media and, you know, consolidating his power over media. And this was a show that originated in America. So there were many issues at that point. The relationship between the U.S. and Russia was already beginning to deteriorate. This was a couple of years before the invasion of Crimea. And I don't know exactly what happened, but Putin's people were in place there. And, you know, they pressured the team to fire one of the key people, is the story I heard. And then everybody else quit in solidarity because they were a tight team.
But this Russians being accused of brutality in Ukraine, and Putin trying to, I don't know, reunify the Soviet Union, for lack of a better word. Is there a lot of tension there among people, you know, between the people who are for and against the war and for and against Putin?
Well, in the last couple of months, of course, I've been in touch with my friends, you know, former colleagues and friends. And initially I sent a quite neutral text because I wasn't sure, you know, how everybody felt. But for the most part, nearly all of our former colleagues are opposed to the war, and many of them have had to flee in the last couple of months. But I would also say that what's most poignant to me is that, you know, many of these hundreds of young men that are marching out of Russia right now and making their voices heard that they do not want to fight and they do not support the war, they are in their late 20s and 30s, and they did grow up on Ulitsa Sazam. And also on the other side, on the Ukrainian side, the same cohort of the same age that are fighting for freedom, they also grew up on Ulitsa Sazam. So for me, that Sesame Street, that Russian Sesame Street generation, it's heartwarming to see that I believe our show did have an impact on, you know, many of these young people who, you know, connected with the Muppets and their values.
Good place to leave it. Natasha Lance Rogoff, the book is called Muppets in Moscow, The Unexpected Crazy True Story of Making Sesame Street in Russia. Natasha, it was great to talk to you. Thank you.
Wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much, Chris.
Here's a look at the week ahead.
Monday.
Former President Trump scheduled to testify under oath to the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th violence at the U.S. Capitol building. The panel issued a subpoena for Trump's testimony at its last hearing, but it's unclear whether he'll comply. The former president has consistently called the committee's investigation a political witch hunt.
Tuesday.
Leaders and representatives of the world's major developed and emerging economies will gather in Bali, Indonesia for this year's G20 summit. President Biden is among the leaders to attend, along with Chinese President Xi Jinping. Russian President Vladimir Putin not expected at the event. Also on Tuesday, former President Trump has said he'll make a major announcement. Political analysts say Trump could announce whether he'll make another run for the White House in 2024. Friday will be the peak of the Leonid meteor showers. If skies are clear, stargazers could see up to 200 shooting stars per hour. And that's a look at your week ahead. I'm Rich Dennison, Fox News.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Rate and review the Fox News Rundown on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
James Carafano.
What's on your mind?
Now that the election's over, from China to Ukraine to the U.S. border, the GOP could reassert its own views on foreign policies. Once the ballots are all counted, and who knows how long that could take, lawmakers will settle down to doing the people's business. Number one, the China jihad. Expect the new Congress to take the gloves off on fighting back against Beijing. Last month's Chinese Communist Party Congress produced what amounted to a clear declaration that Beijing intends to take down the United States. Lawmakers will find no comfort in the administration's recently released national strategies, which declare China to be a problem of the first order, and then offer no real solutions. President Joe Biden is sticking to his mantra of compete where we must, but cooperate where we can. That is akin to declaring Freddy Krueger is real and then taking a sleeping pill. The new Congress won't stand for it. Number two, border security and immigration. Biden's open border policies have seriously hindered his party's chances of coming out way on top of the polls. That lesson will not be lost on congressional leaders. Expect them to press for a return to sensible immigration enforcement policies. And don't be surprised to see a Republican-led House try to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. Number three, provide for the common defense. The Biden administration released its National Defense Strategy, Missile Defense Review, and Nuclear Posture Review all on the same day. Congress has been dissatisfied with Biden's defense policies since day one. His proposed defense budget was so inadequate that even his own party refused to support it. Congress could well look at defense policy and take it into its own hands. Number four, stand with Ukraine. With a twist, don't expect a U-turn on U.S. policy regarding Ukraine. The new Congress won't abandon Ukraine like Biden quit Afghanistan. That said, congressional leaders will draw a finer distinction between supporting the Ukrainian people and supporting Biden administration policies. Expect conservative leadership in Congress to fine-tune both their talking points and their policies. Expect leadership to sharpen the points of concern about the Biden response to the Russian invasion. Military aid should, in fact, have flowed faster and been more robust. Americans also need reassurances that the Europeans are providing their fair share of assistance and that U.S. non-military aid is not being wasted or enriching kleptocrats. Congress should insist on a much better plan for long-term reconstruction, one that will keep Ukraine from becoming another foreign aid dependent basket case like Iraq and Afghanistan. And finally, Americans need to see real and realistic long-term plans to safeguard U.S. interests against further Russian aggression. That said, the new leadership in Congress will also want to demonstrate to our allies that America is a reliable partner, one that makes good on its commitments and lives up to its responsibilities. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network, subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at briankilmeadeshow.com.